Welcome to Seminars at Steamboat, lectures on important public policy issues recorded at the Strings Music Pavilion in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. The following seminar features Christopher Hill, former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Korea, giving a lecture titled Diplomacy and Action, U.S. Options for North Korea. You'll find a full extended question and answer session from the seminar at kunc.org. Seminars at Steamboat board member Ken Krieg introduced Hill at the event, which was recorded on July 16th.
Thanks, Bob. Good afternoon, and let me add my welcome to all of you to this timely discussion on diplomacy in action, U.S. options in North Korea. Last summer, when we were talking about topics, we could all agree on one thing. Asia-U.S. was going to be a hot topic. We couldn't agree on whether it was North Korea, the South China Sea, trade, cybersecurity, and intellectual property theft, or a number of others. Who knew that they would all be the right answer? So we decided we'd find the right person and give him the opportunity for the stage. Ambassador Chris Hill was that choice, was a natural choice, and obviously the turn of events in the intervening 10 months have made U.S.-North Korean relationships one of the hottest topics we could have at seminars. As they say, even in planning seminars, it's better to be lucky than good. If there was a difficult foreign policy issue from the early 90s until 2010, it's likely that Chris Hill was in the middle of it. I asked several of our mutual friends to give me a good story so that I could embarrass him before he came on stage. I struck out completely on that. Chris, you have very good friends. But I repeatedly heard three things. One, if it was hard, he was there. Two, he is nonpartisan and speaks truth to power. And three, his North Star is the American national interest, not his own or anyone else's personal interest. I decided that was a pretty good introduction, and I couldn't say it better. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Ambassador Chris Hill to the stage.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. And if you want, you can just keep on going. It worked for me. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to be back here in Steamboat to be involved again in the Steamboat seminars. Indeed, I thought this is absolutely not only the summer of North Korea, the month of North Korea, maybe even the week of North Korea, but probably not the day of North Korea. So I thought maybe in the course of the Q&A, we can talk about Helsinki. The press conference from Helsinki, and so, but you know, we're going to do our vegetables before we get to the dessert. So I thought it is a good idea to talk about where we've come with North Korea and where we're heading. Now, to illustrate it, I want to mention a totally seemingly irrelevant story from a country that I was assigned to many years ago, actually twice, that is Poland. And even before I got there in the late 50s, there was a Polish party first secretary with the name of Władysław Gomułka, a name that is otherwise kind of lost to history, really. But he was known for very long speeches and not particularly successful metaphors. So one day he got up in front of a crowd in Kraków and said to this enormous crowd who had been waiting a long time for him to come, he said, "Comrades, just a few years ago, our fatherland stood on the very edge of a deep abyss. And I'm here to tell you today, comrades, that we have taken an important step forward." So I think when we talk about North Korea, we do have to consider not taking such steps forward, but rather understanding that this is indeed a tough issue. One that is probably not going to be solved in a 45-minute one-on-one, and one that, frankly, I think as a country we need to kind of coalesce around to understand the importance of finding consensus on this issue. Now, our president has spoken of the failure of the Clinton era to deal with the problem, that is the Clinton administration, which had something called the agreed framework. And then he's spoken about the failure of President Bush in the six-party endeavor, which was an effort to get everybody who had a stake in North Korea in the region with the understanding this is not just an American problem, this is a lot of people's problems. And then finally, the failure of the last administration, President Obama, to really make progress on the issue as well. And that the president would then kind of fix all this. But I think it is informative, if not to the president, then perhaps to the rest of us, to understand what happened in these previous endeavors. So very quickly, I'll just keep these to sort of 30-second explanations. What the Clinton administration sought to do when North Korea, and by the way, this North Korean effort to build a nuclear weapon, it didn't just start with President Trump calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, and nor did it start when President Bush hurt their feelings and said they were part of an axis of evil. It started really way back in the 60s, and this has been an effort by the North Koreans to build weapons of mass destruction. And the question to this day is, well, why? Why are they doing that? And I think many people think that they're building nuclear weapons somehow to keep themselves safe. I mean, after all, they are under threat of attack from the U.S. every day, and therefore they need nuclear weapons such that the U.S. would not think of attacking them. Well, I'm here to suggest to you that the U.S. has not been thinking of attacking North Korea every day. If you talk to any army planner in the U.S. military about what it would involve in going over that fateful 38th parallel again, what the invasion routes might be up to Pyongyang, how we would manage North Korean efforts to infiltrate South Korea and cause kind of havoc in our back of our lines, nobody would be looking forward to an invasion of North Korea. It's understandably thought to be something that would be extremely costly. And so while it would be on the table, especially if North Korea retained its nuclear weapons, it's not something that any president has really contemplated, not since, not since Harry Truman, but he didn't even want to go north of the 38th parallel. That was Douglas MacArthur's idea, and he belatedly informed the president after he had done it. So going to invading North Korea can't really be the motivation for why the North Koreans have nuclear weapons as some kind of defensive measure. After all, they're bereft of allies, they need this. So I'm going to suggest to you that they have wanted nuclear weapons for a different purpose. And that is to say to the U.S., you are the ally of our cousins, the South Koreans, and you have threatened time and time again to come into a conflict if we and the South Koreans get into a pushing and shoving match. You've said that you will be there for the South Koreans, and we're telling you today, not so fast, because if you join in a conflict, if you exercise your alliance, frankly, our obligations under that alliance, to protect South Korea, we will hold your civilians in your cities hostage. That is, we, the North Koreans, are prepared to launch thermonuclear weapons with modern solid fuel rockets, multi-stage rockets, and attack your cities. Well, the Americans have said, we've said for a number of years, hey, make my day. You want to attack us, your country will be a parking lot in no time at all. To which the North Koreans have essentially replied, game on. And when you look at North Korea and you listen to what they say, and not just the KCNA, the North Korean broadcast system that goes out to the world, but what they say domestically to their people is, we North Koreans, We can survive a nuclear attack. We have so much underground. We have dug so many tunnels. It's quite remarkable to go to their subway system, as I have in Pyongyang, and you go to the, I didn't want to go to the Chuche Memorial, which is a sort of kitschy thing with a red star on the top. They wanted to take me to a tourist site, and I said, I'd like to go see your subway. And it went down, if any of you have been to DuPont Circle in Washington, try a subway that's three times deeper than DuPont Circle. I remember talking to my North Korean minder. I said, did the Soviets build this for you? And he said, no, we built it all by ourselves. And the point being, they think that they can tunnel such that they can survive a nuclear war. Pretty crazy stuff. But you have to understand that's part of the mentality of this country that feels that they can survive anything and do anything. So could they survive a nuclear war? Of course not. Frankly, I think very few countries could survive a nuclear war. But the fact that they believe it is something we have to take note of. Moreover, I think the North Koreans don't really plan to get into a nuclear tussle with us. I mean, they are a lot of things, but they're not stupid. So what would be the scenario? The scenario would be something like an American president says, you know those South Koreans, 10th largest country in the world, one of the 10th largest economies in the world, one of the most ferocious militaries. And for those of you who've had opportunities to work and to see what the Republic of Korea military is like, I mean, they are more capable than most of our NATO forces. I should say most of our NATO forces before our president spoke with the NATO leadership, and you know, now it's all different. But as of last week, they were probably more capable than any of our NATO forces. And so you can imagine over the course of time, a North Korean leadership that makes it clear it's prepared to hit us with a nuclear weapon, makes it clear that it doesn't seem to mind trying that. And then a president, whether this one or the next one or the one after that, thinks, do we really need troops in Korea? I mean, surely the South Koreans can handle this on their own. And so what would be the scenario there? The scenario might be that an American president would say something like, you know, we really don't need troops there. They can handle it. So let's start pulling the troops out. I'll get to what happened in Singapore, but I think we need to understand that the long term, the North Koreans are playing a long game, and the long game is get the U.S. out of South Korea. And so that is the purpose of their nuclear weapons. So I think the Trump administration, when they came in, they said, this is easy. We can fix this whole thing. And so sure enough, the president began talking about nuclear war himself, said, you know, they better not, you know, if they think they have a big nuclear button, get a load of ours. And so the consequence was, I think a lot of Americans were thinking, gee, we're thinking of inviting the relatives home for Christmas. But rather than talk about surviving that, they started thinking, can we survive a nuclear war? So it all looked very bleak. It all seemed that our country was heading to war. You know, after all, we have a bigger button than they do. We sent an armada into the Sea of Japan, except that the armada was actually going to do exercises in Australia, which last time I checked on a map is fairly far away from Sea of Japan. And so it all, there was a sort of surrealistic thing that was going on by the end of 2017. And as I mentioned, this history has been around for a while. You had the Clinton administration trying to do a deal and finding that at the end, where they got North Korea to freeze their nuclear weapons, suddenly they discovered toward the end of the Clinton administration that North Korea was making some imports of materials and technology consistent with so-called highly enriched uranium, which is another way to make a bomb. And so the Clinton administration kind of pulled back a little, and the Bush administration ended what they were doing. Then the Bush administration, full disclosure, I was the Foreign Service officer who was designated to work this issue. We worked with other countries on this, with China, with South Korea, with Japan, with Russia. And ultimately, we got them to shut down their reactor. We got inspectors in. We blew up the cooling tower. We did a number of things. And then when we got to the critical point of saying, OK, North Koreans, give us a list of what you got, they excluded any mention of their highly enriched uranium purchases. I asked, you know, could you have brought them in and then kind of left it in the garage, not unlike some Christmas toy that you weren't able to put together. And they said, no, we never brought it in. At one point, I asked them, I said, look, we have some examples of this sort of robust aluminum, sort of an aluminum steel, which would be consistent with the material you need for a centrifuge. And what happened to that? And amazingly, the North Koreans did not deny having brought in a few tons of that stuff, but they said, well, actually, we use it for missile parts. And I said, can we have a look at the factory? And the North Koreans at the time allowed us to have a couple of people go to the factory. At first, the North Koreans tried to say they use it for knives and forks. But we got through that story, and sure enough, it was for they had some missile parts. So we took some of the material, brought it back to Washington, had our specialized agencies look at it, and the result came back, no, this is not for missiles, this is for centrifuges. And so we said to the North Koreans, okay, but let's see, we need a verification deal where we can go look at things that have been undeclared. And sites that are so-called undeclared sites, not sites that we already know about. And that's when the North Koreans balked, and that's when the Bush administration decided to stop trying to negotiate it. It goes to the Obama administration, not a lot happened. So by the end of the 2017, it kind of looked like we were going to get into some kind of shooting match with the North Koreans. And then amazingly, something happened on January 1st, 2018, and that is that Kim Jong-un gave a traditional the traditional annual New Year's Day address, and he addressed the South Koreans, and he said, we wish you well with your Olympics, and we would like to make this a safer peninsula. And he made a lot of sort of friendly sounds, and the South Korean leadership under Moon Jae-in, a new South Korean president who had been selected only about 6 months before, with a mandate to try to calm things down on the Korean Peninsula, sent a delegation up to Pyongyang and to sit down with the North Koreans and said, you know, we took note of your comments about wanting us to have a successful Olympics. Can we work on that? And so indeed, they had a good discussion about it. They worked out an arrangement by which the North Koreans sent an Olympic team and sent an enormous group of cheerleaders. And so at that point, the North Koreans then said one other thing, which they've said every time, they've said since the Clinton era, of course we would like to have a better relationship with America. We would be pleased to invite, our leader to have a meeting with President Trump. So the South Koreans, frankly, they knew that the same offer had been made to George W. Bush, the same offer had been made to Bill Clinton. The South Koreans actually took it right back to Washington. They stopped in Seoul, repacked, and sent a delegation to Washington. And they went into General McMaster's office, the National Security Council advisor at the time. The current one is Mr. Kelly, although I think it's even money whether he will survive the week at this point. But anyway, McMaster, conducting this meeting in his office, in walks President Trump and says, oh, come over to the Oval Office. So the South Koreans, who are frankly a little conscious of protocol and rank, were a little reluctant to go into the Oval Office, but President Trump very warmly invited them there. And they told President Trump that Kim Jong-un would like to have a meeting with him.
And he said, without checking with McMaster or checking with the then Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, a name otherwise like Władysław Gomułka, lost to history. Without checking with anyone, the president said, sure, sounds like a good idea. So at that point, amazingly, the issue became who's going to go out in front of the West Wing and make the announcement. Well, none of the president's staff particularly wanted to do that. And so, lo and behold, the president asked the Koreans if they would go out and do it. And so the Korean National Security Advisor went out and announced that President Trump would be meeting with the North Korean leader. Now, as you recall, it wasn't clear when this was going to happen, and there was a lot of skepticism about whether it was going to happen, but as you recall, it was quite a sensation. And then, of course, you had the North Koreans showing up at the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, and suddenly we're in a whole different world. Well, for me, this was a little rich, I got to tell you, because I can recall President Bush, who sent me to Pyongyang and sent me to 48 meetings with the North Koreans. In fact, I invited President Bush to Denver a few years ago, and he accepted and came to the University of Denver. And the first sentence I wrote in my letter to him was, "Dear Mr. President, a few years ago you asked me to go to Pyongyang, and now I'm asking you to come to Denver." It worked. When you're inviting speakers, you just do what you have to do. So, at the time, President Bush really wanted to make some progress. He wanted to work with China. He wanted to get other countries in the region involved because he didn't want a situation where it's just the North Koreans against the US. Because as soon as there's an impasse, people say, come on, Americans, be more flexible. Whereas if it's an impasse between 1 and 5, that's a different matter. So he understood the math of the equation and very much supported what became known as the six-party talks. But when I went out for my first talks with the North Koreans, there's something you have called instructions. And your instructions come in a telegram from the State Department to, in this case, the embassy in Beijing, because the negotiations were being conducted in China and Beijing. And so the subject line was instructions for Ambassador Hill for meeting with the North Koreans. So fortunately, and this is how it works in the State Department, please don't tell Mr. Trump this, but the negotiator writes his own instructions. I guess President Trump would be okay with that since he was the negotiator at Singapore. But anyway, so I wrote a lot of, you know, what I felt I could live with. You clear it around the building. Everyone says, yeah, that's really what we have in mind. Except that I had what happens is you send a telegram, an uncleared and unsent telegram around, you invite other people to join in with various comments. So I had a lot of good advice, such as, if you are in a room with the North Koreans in any meal or any setting, and someone proposes a toast, thou shalt not toast. So if you're in China, and any of you who've been to China know you can't go 90 seconds in a meeting without someone raising Mao Tai and doing bottoms up. And so I was supposed to sit there with my hands folded while everyone else in the room was toasting champagne or some Chinese drink. In short, I was getting instructions to stay as far away as I could from the North Koreans. You will not meet them except when the Chinese are in the room. Great advice like that, as if that's really going to move the process. In short, you should keep them at an arm's length. And in getting them to yes, you're essentially, I was being asked to sort of have them stripped down while I give them nothing in response. It wasn't going to work. But the irony, the rich irony of that, is some of the people who wrote those instructions are the same people who are in the White House today, and I'm referring to the National Security Advisor, the new one, John Bolton. And that is, I think, we can see a very different approach as our president got ready for this meeting in Singapore. I can assure you the president wasn't saying to anyone, and when I go there, I'm going to refuse to shake his hand, I'm going to refuse to reciprocate a toast, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, the president made very clear, I'm going to size him up real quick, and then I'm going to make him my best friend, and then he's going to give up his weapons because he'll see the proposition that I've laid out. So off to Singapore they go. It was there are a couple of dicey moments before they went to Singapore. There was, for example, the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, saying that North Korea should embrace the Libya model. Well, when I was dealing with this back in 2005, John Bolton and many others also talked about the Libya model. But this was 2005, and you know, there were subsequent events in Libya. But in 2005, what had happened was that via a long-standing negotiation facilitated by the Brits, but joined in by various American senior officials, including our assistant secretary at the time from Near East Bureau, Bill Burns, and others, sat down with the North Koreans Libyans in London and worked out a deal by which they would simply give up all of their nuclear equipment. They didn't have any fissile material. They had never made a reactor. They had never made centrifuges. They've never produced any fissile material. But they said, okay, look, this, we don't want to deal with this. It's all yours. And so we essentially bought back from the Libyans all this stuff. And after we had done that, we then agreed to send a senior official to Tripoli. And the senior official turned out to be Condoleezza Rice. And she has a hilarious story about meeting Gaddafi for the first time and having him chase her around his tent for some time. But she fulfilled her duty of coming to Tripoli, and that was the contribution. That was the sort of quid pro quo, a senior official. So what John Bolton, who was around in those days and since went off into being a news commentator, so he comes back into government, the first thing he says is they should accept the Libya model, except for the fact that a few things had happened in Libya in the meantime, including a rather unusual state funeral for Muammar Gaddafi. And so, needless to say, this was not well received by the North Koreans. Now, of course, they resurrected what they had referred to. This is rather unpleasant, but they, back in 2005, when they had their first encounter with John Bolton, they referred to him as human scum. There's no end to the North Korean capacity to insult people. Although they say, hey, we called him human, what do you want? When they saw him up in the net again, and when they saw him with this, in their view, very mischievous proposal that they should follow the Libya model, they were not amused. And then a few days later, you recall the Vice President Pence, also referred to the Libyan model. And so at that point, the North Koreans were sort of worried, whoa, this Boltonism is spreading, and this is going to be a disaster. We're not sure we're going to go through with this. Well, the president very quickly put an end to that concern. First of all, he invited kind of second-ranking North Korean Kim Jong-chol to New York, where he met with our Secretary of State, who by that time had already made three visits to North Korea. And Kim Jong-chol brought with him an envelope which had a message in it from Kim Jong-un. And for me, it was kind of interesting to watch because they said, Kim Jong-chol said, my instructions are I must deliver this message in person. Whereupon Secretary Pompeo told the president, and the president said, of course. So Kim Jong-chol is invited to the White House. Now, I'll give you an example of what I was dealing with back in 2005. Actually, it was 2007. I said to Condoleezza Rice, it would really help me if I could have a letter from the president. She ran it up the flagpole. The president said, I'm not writing no letter to Kim Jong-il. And so the problem was, of course, that I needed something to take to the meeting. So I said, I counterproposed with Secretary Rice, and I said, how about if he sends five letters to all the other six party members, one of them, of course, to the North Korean leader, and then I'll carry that when I go to Pyongyang next week. So Condi, who we all called her Condi, she developed a pretty good sense of rolling her eyes at some of these ideas, said, all right, I'll do it. And so sure enough, I had a letter from President Bush, and I took it to North Korea, and I said, I have a letter for your leader. Take me to your leader, and because my instructions are, I must deliver it to him in person. So the deputy foreign minister said, it's not possible, he's out of town. I said, that's not a problem, I will wait. And then they said, he is far out of town. And I said, not a problem, I will go wherever he is because I have an important letter. It was actually sort of the same, it was the same letter that everyone else got, but I thought it was worth a try. And so the North Koreans dug in, and we're about 2 hours from our departure. We were there for 2 days. So I spoke to the representative on my team from the National Security Council staff, Paul Hanley, and Paul said, you know, we're supposed to deliver that letter. And he said, it was a nice try on having to give it to the Kim Jong-il himself, but it really was not in our instructions. And I said, don't do it too loudly for the walls. But so we find, so eventually, with 2 hours to go, I went to the foreign minister and I said, I have great news. We've received new instructions and I can give the letter to you. Anyway, the North Koreans didn't have to go through with any of that. They took their letter, which was, by the way, a normal size letter, except it was in a 13 by 20 envelope. It looked like one of those game show things, you know, you want a new dishwasher or something. But and the president agreed to meet him. So all seemed to be okay, but I was asking people, do we have some sense of what they're prepared to agree to? Because I thought it was kind of important. I mean, we've gotten all this from the South Koreans, who really want this whole problem to calm down. But we hadn't heard really directly. Pompeo had been there, but at no time did he say something like, they told me that. He said, they indicate that. You always have to be careful when people use words like indicate rather than said. So sure enough, there was no real indication, if you will, that they were prepared to give up their nuclear weapons. Secretary Pompeo asked a person who was my deputy, now the ambassador in Philippines, Sung Kim, if he would go to North Korea in the week before the Singapore summit. I wrote to Sung and I said, I wrote to him and I said, Sung, I got three words for you, draft joint communique. Let's see if we can have an agreement on what's going to be the outcome of the summit. Because, you know, normally a summit, especially a summit which is at those kinds of high stakes, you know, when you're pulling a rabbit out of a hat and everyone says, my goodness, that's brilliant. Well, it's brilliant except that rabbits don't live in hats. Somebody took some time to stuff the rabbit down the hat. And so, and those people are called diplomats. And Sung, who had worked with me for too long and knew that when I wasn't doing baseball metaphors, I was doing metaphors like that, he said, I don't know, something to that effect. So anyway, the president arrives in Singapore, and this whole edifice of our policy toward North Korea, that of isolating them, was gone. I mean, there is no isolation from North Korea. If you want to go see the leader of North Korea, you better take a number, because he is meeting everybody right now, because the isolation is essentially over. And so he meets with the president, and strangely, there's no there is no prepackaged joint agreement. That is, they went in without knowing what the outcome was going to be. And so, I mean, one of the questions, if I believe that there was anyone in the universe who had lived before me, I would have taken what they had done. Take our six-party statement, for example, from September 2005, and I would have said to the North Koreans, here is the statement you agreed to, in which you agreed to abandon all your nuclear weapons and all your nuclear programs and return to the non-proliferation treaty. Here's what you agreed to in those days. Do you still agree to this? If not, what do you not agree with? You can get kind of an idea of what they don't agree with and what they still do agree with. We had a line in there about how the US and North Korea would agree to live peacefully together. We had a line there about establishing diplomatic relations. We even had a line there about having a treaty that would in effect replace the armistice that ended the Korean War and really be an end to that war. So all of that was there. The question would have been to say to the North Koreans, what part of this, which they've rejected in the intervening years since 2008, but what part of this do you agree with and what part do you not agree with? Instead, they sit down and produce out of whole cloth a whole other statement. But I think people who had watched this, who had looked very carefully at this statement in Singapore, realized it didn't really come close to the statements that were reached in the past, including the one in September 2005. For example, it talks about North Korea's willingness to give up its nuclear weapons, but it does not address the question of when. Now, in the 2005, it didn't say when, but it said return to the non-proliferation treaty at an early date, meaning they come back in the non-proliferation treaty, and the only status they could have in returning is a non-nuclear state. It's kind of all spelled out there. Some of it's kind of code, but you can figure it out. So in the Singapore statement, it wasn't at all clear that they were agreeing to give up nuclear weapons. Now, the North Koreans have a kind of Marxist notion, lo and behold, of giving up nuclear weapons. For example, in Marxist ideology, you talk about the state withering away to be replaced by the Communist Party. That is the point at which you have pure communism. In the meantime, you have something communists refer to as socialism, which we see as communism, just pure communism. And that is where you have a state existing alongside a party structure, which is what every Communist Party that's still in existence has. So they talk about eventually withering away. You also have these concepts in the Bible that, you know, when the lambs lie down with the lions, you know, that's when we'll have denuclearization. In short, there was no effort to set out a time frame there. And what was rather odd, I was spending the night literally at NBC Studios, and they had asked me to be there to provide some commentary. So at 2 a.m. our time in New York, 2 p.m. in Singapore time, it was revealed that there was going to be a signing, but no one even knew what the signing was about. Were they exchanging autographs? What were they going to do? So there was this big mahogany table and a couple of these big leather portfolios and a huge double door in the background. And so we got the impression there was going to be a signing ceremony, but we didn't know what they were actually going to sign. So this was at 2 in the morning, our time. And so Kim Jong-un and President Trump walk out. They sit down. Kim Jong-un's sister, who made famous during the Seoul Olympics, she was there to turn the portfolio and show her brother where he is supposed to sign. In our case, we had our Secretary of State doing that for President Trump. There was some asymmetry there, but whatever. And then, amazingly, President Trump, no one knew what they were signing, or there was speculation. I was next to David Gura, who was the NBC anchor at that point. They had all-night coverage. And so David turned to me and said, do you know what they're signing? I said, I don't know. Beats the heck out of me. We'll have to find out. And then President Trump held up the statement, and someone used an iPhone, took a picture of the statement, and beamed it around the world. We were able to read the statement off of the iPhone photograph. And And so I'm sitting there with David Gura at this NBC at 30 Rock at this large table, and someone comes in and throws a statement at me, and I start reading it, and I realize this was a fairly incomplete thing, and that there was certainly a lot of goodwill involved in the statement. You could see that from the North Korean side. You could certainly see that from President Trump's side. But it was not a roadmap, really, for going forward. So what happened was the next question, and people who know this kind of stuff, David Sanger from the New York Times, you know, there are a lot of these journalists who followed this program for this issue for half their lives. They began to say, well, you know, this doesn't come close to what they agreed in 1992 or what they agreed in 2005. And the only thing that was clear about it was it said, Secretary Pompeo will continue the diplomatic work. And then when you say, okay, let's see if the North Koreans did any prep work ahead of this time. And then they said a player to be named later, or words to that effect, from North Korea would be in charge of their delegation. It's turning out to be Kim Jong-chul, but it wasn't at all clear from the statement. So after this whole Singapore fling, if you will, the decision was then, we're going to go ahead, but how do we go ahead? Secretary Pompeo went back this time. I lose track, but I think actually he had gone twice before. This was his third trip. And by comparison, no other sitting secretary, except for Madeleine Albright at the very end of the Clinton administration, has ever been to North Korea. And already this Secretary of State has been there three times in a tenure that's been about 4 months, if my memory serves me correctly. So Secretary Pompeo actually is a guy who does reach out to people and does try to kind of sample other people's opinions about this, regardless of which administration you were working in or what you were doing at the time. So he called me up and asked me what I thought he ought to do, and I said, well, the first thing is we need a clear statement. I didn't mean that what happened in Singapore was not clear, but I think he got the point. And I said, you know, you're going to need a clear understanding of what the North Koreans are prepared to accept and prepared to do. And I told him, I would suggest you start off with a complete listing of their nuclear programs. I recalled to him that when we tried to get that in the summer of 2008, the North Koreans had refused to include highly enriched uranium, that other way to a bomb. They had all the plutonium stuff all in there, but they didn't have the highly enriched uranium. So I told them, if you could get highly enriched uranium in a North Korean statement, even if the statement's incomplete in other ways, that would be the first time they've actually overtly admitted it officially, and that would be valuable if you could do that. We then had a discussion about one of the key things that one has to consider, and that is, how do you put together a team of people? He, I think, representing the fact that he is, you know, certainly by standards of this administration, he is very ecumenical. He wants to get as many people involved as possible, try to work with others. And so I told him that I thought he should try to get various elements of the administration in, even though many of us suspect that the current National Security Advisor, John Bolton, unless he's had some kind of, Saul to Paul type falling off of his horse somewhere, he's probably still dead set against this. So I won't say what he said, but I'll say what I said, which is he, you have to be careful about bringing people who are dead set against something inside the tent, because we all know the LBJ aphorism that somehow it's better to have people in the tent than out of the tent. And I said, yeah, but sometimes they can mess up the sleeping bags and everything, so you better be careful about who you bring in the tent. So we had a little discussion about that, but I found it very gratifying that the Secretary of State was thinking about these issues. And then I told him, and I keep saying I did this because I don't really want to, he can speak for himself. I'm not going to say what he said, but I told him that I thought the biggest issue emanating from Singapore is the fact that there is no regional architecture yet. That is, if the US thinks it can talk to North Korea, sort everything out with the North Koreans, and then go to the Chinese and tell them belatedly, I just want to give you an update on how we're doing with the North Koreans, that's not going to work with China. And frankly speaking, it's not going to work with South Korea, and it's certainly not going to work with Japan. So I think it's very important that as the administration goes forward, they work out a way, if they don't want to call it the six-party talks, because everything has to be sort of dreamed of for the first time ever in human history by the current administration, fine, call it something else. I always remember the Russian interpreter in our six-party talks. He was never comfortable with the term working group, so whenever he was translating into English from Russian, he would say, the working groups, and then he would pause and say, that is to say, the groups at work. So I understand they don't want to do six parties, then talk party of six, whatever you need to do, but you need to get a sense of the regional architecture. And I know there are a lot of people who say, why would we ever want to deal with China in this? Well, I tell you, working with China is hard. Working against China is pretty near impossible, especially when you're talking about issues that are right on their border. And so I think we need to be respectful. I didn't tell him that, but I'm telling you this. We need to be respectful of the fact that we're not the only country with equities there. And I did say, because while this wasn't in that Singapore statement, it was in the president's press conference in Singapore, in which he said that he would cancel the U.S. Republic of Korea exercises. And I suggested that, first of all, the president learned to speak some North Korean, because he said we will cancel the war games, which are the hostile war games, which is only an expression the North Koreans use. So I felt that in announcing that, having talked about it with the North Koreans, it's all fine, except he was talking to the wrong Korea. He should have been talking to the South Koreans about the question of, do you think it's a good idea to postpone exercises for this year, such that they will not be an irritant while we're trying to move forward on the nuclear talks. And I'll bet the South Koreans would go along with it. I don't think they would be thrilled about it. The North Koreans asked me all the time about canceling exercises, and I would say I got to the point, I got kind of sarcastic with them, which is something that happens when you deal with the North Koreans, and I said, you know, I do have a regret about our exercises, that is, that we didn't have them in the spring of 1950. They have asked this question about exercises of everybody. And you can picture the scene saying, and we request that the war games conducted by the U.S. and their so-called allies be canceled. I can imagine them kind of reading this from rote, and the president says, done, and they kind of look up saying, my gosh, first time ever we've gotten an affirmative answer to that question. I think it sends a signal of weakness, and I worry about that. But I think what the president then said was even more worrisome, which is, we want to bring our troops home. And that comment just went through South Korea, even among people who think North Korea is the greatest place in the world. And there are, sadly, some South Koreans who really feel that if the foreigners would only get out, South Korea and North Korea could work this out. But even those people, I think, had a little problem with the idea of withdrawing U.S. forces. And, you know, an American, anyone can make a comment like that, but when you're president, when you are a president and you make that comment, a lot of people are listening and taking it with the utmost seriousness. First of all, the Japanese have worried about this whole process from the start. I was in Japan last November, and they said, you know, we've been very tough, but we really are worried that your administration, we will be out there very tough, and then your administration will change, and we will change its view, and we will still be out there on our own. The Japanese had a lot of concerns and have even greater concerns. So it fell to Mr. Pompeo not only to visit North Korea again, but to also try to tamp down these issues with the neighbors. And I think in the process, try to come to terms with the need for some sort of architecture in the region. I guess the fundamental question we all have is this going to lead to anything? I mean, after all, North Korea has been at this for 60 plus years. And will they give up their nuclear weapons? I mean, this is the question everyone asks. My own view is yes. It is not an unqualified yes. They're not going to say it at a 45-minute meeting in Singapore. They're not even going to say it in a course of a two-day meeting in Pyongyang with the Secretary of State. But I think the fundamental proposition that has to be put forward to the North Koreans is, would you be better off with these weapons or without these weapons? With the understanding that we put forward a series of very tough measures. We put forward the idea that without these weapons, if you give up these weapons, we are prepared to do a lot with you, including civil nuclear program, including civil nuclear, that is nuclear reactors to help power. So we're prepared to do that. We're prepared to help you trade. We're prepared to integrate you in the international community. We are not prepared to do any of that if you continue with your nuclear weapons. And if you do continue with your nuclear weapons, we will come after you wherever you are. If you think you have trouble opening bank accounts today, just wait, because we will make sure that no bank in the world is going to ever open a North Korean bank account again. If you try to open a bank account on the moon, we will build a rocket ship, or maybe those SpaceX people will build a rocket ship, go up to the moon, and shut down that bank account as well. We will make your lives a living hell as long as you keep these nuclear weapons. So I think if you put forward that kind of proposition, a series of sticks and a series of carrots, it won't happen overnight because the North Koreans feel they've really accomplished something with nuclear weapons. But it is also to say that they really need to understand that we will not let this problem go. And to those people, such as John Bolton, I hate to keep picking on him, but why not after today? To those people who think they're really tough and say things like they'll never give up their nuclear weapons, and as if to prove their proposition, undermine every negotiation aimed at giving up their nuclear weapons, they are not doing this country any service whatsoever. We need to empower our negotiators to do what they need to do. We need to be prepared to, if we have to shake hands with the North Koreans, we should shake hands with the North Koreans. If we have to toast with them, we should toast with them. But we need to keep in sharp focus what the aim is. And the aim is to make it clear to them that there will be a series of sticks and carrots aimed at making sure they understand that keeping those nuclear weapons will be a strategic mistake. So whether we get there in this administration, I cannot say for sure. Whether we get through another day with this administration, I cannot be sure. But what I am sure is if those people who understand the overall dynamics of this problem, who understand that nuclear weapons in the hands of North Korea is unacceptable. We cannot accept a few nuclear weapons. We have to get to a zero option. We have to be bold in that kind of thinking. But we also have to come together and try to work these things out, whether it's Secretary Pompeo, whether it's Madeleine Albright. People need to come together on this issue and understand that whoever gets the credit for this eventually. And I think, you know, in diplomacy, when good things happen, it's not because one person did something. It's like a scientific invasion, invention. Not one person made a scientific invention. Someone made the penultimate invention that allowed the next invention. So there needs to be a much more ecumenical approach to this. We need to have a president who understands that it is useful to call his predecessors. It is useful to his success to call his predecessors and understand understand what his predecessors went through, because North Korea with nuclear weapons is a danger to our interests. It's a danger to our regional interests in Northeast Asia. And frankly, we need to deal with this problem. And as for dealing with countries like China, this is not easy, but China is going to be around for a while, maybe as long as we're going to be around. And you know, perhaps we should think in terms of North Korea as an issue that brings the US and China together. I've often said if we should someday build a statue to the North Korean leadership for helping to bring the US and China together. Because if our two countries can't work together and work together a lot better than what we're doing right now, I think we're going to leave ourselves in a situation where the world is not an easier place to live in. So with those comments, maybe we can go to a more interactive procedure. Thank you very much.
Well, you opened it up with, I think, the question that everybody has on their mind. In the last 3 weeks, we've had 4 weeks, we've had a challenging G7, we've had a difficult NATO meeting, and today we had an interesting session. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, when the administration started, I thought, every administration goes through a learning curve. And I thought that given the fact that our president has not had government service or military service, I'll stop there, that this would be a steeper learning curve than some of the others. I think I was way too optimistic. And I think what we're seeing, what we saw in the treatment of our allies, which actually started with Justin Trudeau and has continued throughout, is a president who, whatever one thinks of his personal attributes, he has not understood the meaning of the fact that he serves the state. And when you serve the state, you can have personal opinions. I mean, believe me, if you had invited me 10 years ago, I wouldn't have said a tenth of what I said today, because you represent the state, and you have to understand that there are issues that are, that represent U.S. government policy, and you have to be respectful of what U.S. government policy is. And you don't say, well, the state, that's me, and I'll just make my own policy. And so I think to some extent the president has not come to grips with the fact that he's the chief executive. And as such, he has to manage others' opinions and sometimes different opinions. I can remember George W. Bush. I wanted him to raise some aircraft issue. We were trying to sell F-16s to Poland. And I said, I really want you to raise the issue of selling F-16s to Poland, which, by the way, were made in Fort Worth, Texas. And he said, you really want me to mention airplanes at this summit meeting with the Polish president? And he didn't want to have to do that, and he felt it looked bad because he's talking about planes that are essentially fabricated in his own state, and he kind of felt that was the wrong thing to do. And a number of people, including Secretary Rice, made the point that, look, we are up against competition, and they press for their planes. And besides that, we want Poland to have NATO an American plane so they can fly with us. And that is part of why we have allies, so that we can, fight side by side. And the president did it, even though it was completely contrary to his instincts. I think President Trump needs to be more respectful when people come up and say, you got to do this. He may not like it, but he needs to understand that we have policies, we have a government where people have thought these things through. And so I think what we've seen in the last few weeks is a president who's become, it's gotten worse, and he's become a little less tethered than before. And I'm afraid it's not going to get better until some other people step up and show some guts and be prepared to say, no, that's wrong.
Thank you very much.
This has been a special presentation of Seminars at Steamboat. You can find the extended question and answer session on our website, kunc.org. Join us next Sunday evening at 8 for more from Seminars at Steamboat. The radio broadcast was produced by Ryan Thompson for KUNC. Special thanks to Bob Stein, Jenny Lay, the Steamboat pilot and today, and the staff of the Strings Music Pavilion for their support. Music by Scott Holmes. Find information on future seminars at seminars@steamboat.org. This is KUNC.
This is KUNC 91.5 Greeley, Fort Collins.
KRNC 88.5 Steamboat Springs.
KVNC 90.9 Minturn Vale.
KENC 90.7 Estes Park.
And KMPB 90.7 Breckenridge.